basic laws of Israel have been changed 22 times in the last 5 years. Folks, if your constitution can be changed by an ordinary majority in your unicameral parliament, which has no other institutions around it, no president, no second house to in any way, you know, veto or limit or force a compromise, if just that one majority in that single unilateral unicameral parliament can change your constitution at will, pretty much within a week, those laws maybe should be reviewable. Or if you're going to have a constitution that is unreviewable, make that constitution difficult to change and requiring a broad compromise in society. Israel has a big problem. Israel has almost no institutions. Its parliament is unicameral. Its government, by definition, has a parliamentary majority, or it can't survive as a government. It has almost no other checks of any kind. Because we are, our elections are a proportional single constituency, proportional representation electoral system, in actual practical terms, our members of Knesset aren't elected regionally. They're not elected personally in any way. Most political parties in the Israeli Knesset actually don't have any kind of primary process. And so most MKs, I don't know the exact number, but I can look it up, but just educated guess, I'm going to throw out 90, all of Yesh Atid, all of Israel Beitenu. In many ways, most of Likud. Likud has a primary process, but the primary process is almost entirely subject to Netanyahu's decisions. In other words, he passes around a list, and that list is what the Likud list looks like. And that is a party with a primary system. But the vast majority of Israeli MKs owe their jobs not to the voters directly, but to their party leaders. And what that means is that they are incredibly, incredibly disciplined. Likud has 30 members of Knesset, and there is no debate on this judicial reform of any kind in any party institution or in the Knesset inside the ruling party. None of the 30 believe that they have the ability, the political space in which to open their mouths and talk in any way, in any criticism of any kind. There was a meeting of the Knesset Economy Committee in which economists came and warned the MKs that there are going to be economic ramifications, bad ones, to this judicial reform. A single member of Likud showed up to the committee and left quickly. And so we have very, very weak MKs who don't stand on their own two feet. They don't have their own constituency and can, you know, like a Joe Manchin, who can be very independent. And we have no other checks on that parliament. And that single majority will now be able to both appoint the judges on their own, overcome any judicial ruling throwing out any law or any executive action, review any, pass any law as a basic law, and deny the court even the ability to review in the first place. This is a judicial reform that leaves the ruling majority in absolute power. And the first reading of two major planks of this reform passed yesterday. And immediately after that passed, Benjamin Netanyahu went on television, or rather put out a video that went on the news as well. And he said, he used that video to call for a compromise. He said, "My fellow Israelis, I hear the voices of the proponents of the plan and the opponents of the plan. And I say to you, now is the time for leadership. Come to the table. Let's negotiate. Let's compromise." And the Israeli center left is opposed to him doing so, is opposed to sitting down and compromising with him and discussing with him, because he has refused multiple times to actually freeze the legislation, have a negotiation process. The legislation moves forward on the parliamentary schedule. They have about 6 weeks before they're going to pass everything. And whatever the center left is being told, whatever you can negotiate us down from in that time, great. Otherwise, I have passed the first reading of these two measures in order to show you that I have the numbers. Netanyahu showed that he can pass anything. His MKs are disciplined. They will pass whatever he says. And now he wants the center left to come to a negotiating process. I want to tell you something important about Netanyahu, and I will stop talking after that, about where he actually is at. I do not believe that Netanyahu is strong and that he is pushing forward this massive judicial reform, really profound and very, very controversial, and incidentally not popular. Every poll we have, including by right-wing pollsters, tells us roughly a quarter of the country is willing to go along with this, and three quarters are opposed. Many, many Likud voters are opposed to this reform. And yet Netanyahu is pushing ahead. And I think that the reason he's doing so is not because he's strong, but because he's weak. Netanyahu has a problem within his coalition. And that problem means that, you know, there's been this debate in Israel over the last 2 months. What does Netanyahu actually want? Does he want to, is this a negotiating gambit? In other words, does he come forward with an extreme measure in order to be negotiated to a middle ground? Or in fact, does he actually want this system in which there are no more checks and balances in the Israeli system, essentially? And the general consensus has been among people who know Netanyahu's record, who think about this seriously, who aren't prone to panic, the general consensus has been that this is a negotiating tactic. Netanyahu often presents, you know, radical ideas and then is, you know, so to speak, forced, right, to negotiate back into what he actually originally wanted. If you start with what you want, you get less than what you want. If you start much farther than what you want, things you don't want, they force you back to where you wanted to be the whole time. The problem with that theory is Netanyahu's coalition. Here's the problem. Each element of Netanyahu's coalition, religious Zionism, the ultra-Orthodox parties, Shas and United Torah Judaism, and Yariv Levin, the justice minister from Likud, each element believes that a different piece of the reform is make or break, is something that they will leave the coalition over, is existential for them. I'll explain. Yariv Levin and Simcha Rotman, the chairman of the Knesset Law Committee from Religious Zionism, are two people who are ideologically committed to this reform. They have been talking about the Supreme Court's overreach and massive powers and unhealthy powers for 20 years. They have convinced a great deal of this country. A reform is a popular idea. It actually is a majority of the Israeli public. This reform is a minority opinion and it has minority support. But they have convinced the Israeli public that our court is too strong, that we don't have a healthy relationship between the various branches of government, and that that needs to be reformed. Simcha Rotman has written two books on the question of judicial reform. These are people deeply committed. And they don't really care about the reasonableness clause. If you tell a judge, an activist judge, you cannot rule something is unconstitutional because of a test of reasonableness. Guess what? That judge will say, well, I'm not allowed to rule on reasonableness, but this is disproportionate, right? I can rule on proportionality. There's always, lawyers are semanticists. Let's pretend like I know which one that is. Lawyers love words, and there'll always be a word and a trick and a mental, if a judge is innately in their basic personality and their basic legal culture activist, they will find a way around it. And so denying them reasonableness is no great victory, according to Yariv Levin and Simcha Rotman. A 61 override is really very problematic, and there have been indications from both Likud and Religious Zionism that they're not only willing to compromise on the 61 override, they actually want to compromise. They want that to be dumped. There have been people from the Kohelet Policy Forum, this conservative think tank that's funded largely by American donors and has been writing and thinking about this a great deal. And some of the people in the Kohelet think tank in Jerusalem have really been the architects and the original drafters of a lot of these reforms. And they have written public op-eds arguing that the override should be thrown aside as part of the compromise. So the Levin, Rothman, Likud, Religious Zionism, you know, ideologically the court needs to be reined in camp, doesn't want the override. What does it need? What does it desperately need? And Yariv Levin has threatened to resign if he doesn't get it, which would be a terrible political blow for Netanyahu with his base, never mind inside Likud. They need the judicial appointments. Rothman and Levin basically say, if I can appoint conservative judges, I've solved my problem. And if I can't appoint conservative judges, none of the other things will work. None of them will really matter. I need those conservative judges, and I can give up, I can compromise on all the rest. They think in that sense, they think in American terms. But the Haredi parties think the opposite. The Haredi parties believe that the Supreme Court is against them, will always be against them. The Supreme Court of Israel has ruled in ways that are very problematic for the ultra-Orthodox community for many, many years, including on the military draft, including on many other issues. that they care about very much on their education system, on funding for their education system. If they don't teach core curriculum, how much state funding can they get? These are questions that are existential for their community, or they see it that way at least, and the Supreme Court has essentially been against them. The problem here is that the Supreme Court has been against them, both liberals and conservatives. In other words, the problem with the military draft is that we forcibly draft people, and then we forcibly draft them only based on their religious identity and their communal identity. And that's unequal. That's inequality. That's a blow to human dignity, which is promised under Israel's basic laws. Conservative judges won't suddenly allow a complete, you know, all ultra-Orthodox Jews to not have to serve in any kind of national service. And so Moshe Gafni, the head of United Torah Judaism, has said, he's now the deputy head, he's the former head of United Torah Judaism, has said openly, I don't need, you know, it doesn't matter to me if the judges are conservative or liberal. It doesn't matter to me if they're 10% more activist or less activist. I don't care about reasonableness. I don't care about overthrowing laws. The only thing I need is an override. And I need it to be 61. Because the ultra-Orthodox can threaten a coalition in the Knesset with toppling the coalition if they don't get what they want. And none of the other measures really give them what they want. They need to know that if the court rules that they can't live in their particular lifestyle in any way, shape, or form, that they could just say no. They could just override it. And so you have and by the way, the demand for the override was the number one demand for joining this coalition, and it's in the coalition agreements with Netanyahu. And Gafni has said openly, we're leaving without it. And their rabbinical councils and rabbinical leaders have said the same thing. Netanyahu, I'll stop there. It gets deeper. The ultra-Orthodox have already started to advance bills that will challenge the court in order to be able to use that override. For example, bills massively expanding the powers of the rabbinic courts so that they can deal with arbitration on civil matters, which is something rabbinic courts in Israel have never been able to do, banning chametz from hospitals on Passover. Hospitals treat non-Jews as well. Those non-Jews will be eating matzahs on Passover. This is something that had never existed before in Israel, and they're going to pass a bill now to make it happen. The bill to allow Aryeh Deri to return into the cabinet is a basic law that is being advanced. Again, it takes no more votes than a regular law. Long story short, Netanyahu is trapped. It's a trap of his own making. You should feel no pity for him. But he's trapped in a coalition where each piece wants a different part of the reform. And each piece will walk away if it doesn't get it, because each piece believes that that part is existential. How do you compromise? When Netanyahu yesterday went on television and said to the Israeli center left, to Yair Lapid, come to the table, show leadership, show responsibility, let's bring a better compromise for this country. He was begging. He was begging. He needs the center left to force him to compromise in ways that essentially break his most basic promise, that coalition forming promise, to one or another of his partners. Or this whole reform passes essentially as is. And the center left doesn't want to play that game. One of the reasons the center left doesn't want to play that game, I spoke to one very important member of Knesset from the center left over the past few days, who is helping to handle this strategy for the center left parties. One of the reasons is they want him to be forced to live with the responsibility of, in other words, they're willing to have the worst version of this reform pass and all the damage happen so that Netanyahu finally takes responsibility. The center left has said publicly, look, nothing is stopping you from passing the reform you know we need. As Isaac Herzog, the president, said multiple times over the last 3 weeks, there is a middle ground here that leaves us more democratic and stronger than either side. We could stay as we are, which is a very unbalanced way to live. The Supreme Court is too powerful, and we have almost no other institutions and checks. We need more institutions and checks, not less. Dismantling the Supreme Court alone is not the solution to this problem. In general, in the democratic world, there's a negative correlation between the power a court possesses and the political influence over appointments to it. The more powerful the court, for example, the American Supreme Court is relatively powerful, and the process for appointing it as a way to rein in that court, the process for appointing justices is very political. In Britain, the court is relatively weak, much weaker certainly than the American court, And the process is much less political. The political echelon has much less influence over appointments. The Israeli Supreme Court today is incredibly powerful, maybe the most powerful court in the West, and their political forces, political elected echelons, have almost no ability to really influence. If the court votes to veto whoever it wants to veto, it's very difficult to appoint a justice that the rest of the court doesn't want. That's an outlier. It's too powerful and it's too independent for such a powerful court. But Yariv Levine's reform would make it almost powerless, probably the weakest court in the West. Courts are complicated. Not every country has a court that can do judicial review at all. Finland, I think, does not. But nevertheless, so it gets a little complicated, and I don't want to get into that complexity. But it becomes one of the weaker courts in the democratic world, and the appointment process utterly politicized. In other words, this is a reform that takes the court from an absolute outlier on one end to an absolute outlier on the other, and says President Herzog, guys, if we stop in the middle, if we have judicial, if basic laws are immune to judicial review, but it takes 70 or 80 MKs to pass them, in other words, they're protected, and you need some kind of compromise, some kind of, not unanimity, but certainly a mainstream that comes together to say this is the country we want, and they define what the basic laws are, and you immunize that to judicial review, Israel's finally gotten a constitution. Right? If you have an override, but it's 75 MKs, you force compromise with the opposition. If you say reasonableness can't be applied to appointments to the cabinet, that's a standard in many countries. But you don't remove reasonableness from the toolkit that judges can use to protect me from some eminent domain claim where the country wants to break my house, you know, tear down my house to build a highway. You can't remove reasonableness as a legal instrument. So says Herzog, guys, there is a middle ground that leaves us stronger and healthier and better. I am over my time by a couple of minutes. I'll stop there. Netanyahu is in a trap, a genuine trap, a trap of his own making. The center left isn't rushing to rescue him from that trap. And bottom line, what that means is at this moment, people who are following very, very closely how this reform is moving through the system don't know how we get out of it. In other words, how we reach, instead of this wild swing from one end to the other, which is a real genuine threat to our democracy, it's a genuine and profound constitutional crisis, and the politics have trapped us into this path to extremism. We don't right now see a political path out. When Yair Lapid turned down Netanyahu's call for compromise, for negotiations yesterday, he used the phrase, without shticks and without tricks. Mr. Netanyahu, without shticks and without tricks, why don't you freeze the advancing legislation by 60 days, and we'll use those 60 days to talk. And Netanyahu refuses to freeze the legislation. Without shticks and without tricks is Netanyahu's promise to Benny Gantz 2 years ago that he would fulfill the promise to rotate the premiership. He would be prime minister and then he would rotate and Gantz would be prime minister. And he said to Benny Gantz on national television, I promise you before the whole people, without tricks and without shticks, that this is something that I will do. And so Yair Lapid is saying, Bibi, we don't trust you. If we could trust you, this would be a different story. But you've lied to too many people too often that just trusting you is not a reason to enter these negotiations. Netanyahu is saddled with the problem of his own making and this very, very extreme version of the law, of this reform, which its own defenders don't really defend. They do not give us answers, is moving forward.
Great. Habib, thank you for tackling all of that. There's a lot to talk about, and obviously there's a lot of passionate questions and conversations by members of our audience. So let me try to, you know, tackle some of them with the time that we have and try to deal with this. My friend and colleague Shlomo Dubnov, has a question about the some of the polls that have been coming out of Israel as far as the need to that there is a majority inside of Israel that there is a need for reform in these in the judicial system at large, but to try to find some kind of compromise. Obviously, polls are subjective, and I'm sure you've seen polls all over the place, but you've also spoken in your remarks about the fact that The debate, you know, that there is a need, you know, there's been a conversation in Israel for the past, at least you said 20 years, about reforming, given what the court has been doing. Can you talk a little bit, maybe highlight a little bit, you know, the difference between what the people are seeing, you know, as far as the overhaul in the judicial system versus obviously their feelings about the government and Netanyahu, maybe kind of, you know, contextualize it that way.
You mean in the public?
Yeah, in the public.
I would say that we've spent 45 months or so on a referendum of Netanyahu. We know exactly where everyone stands. People who disagree with Netanyahu, who dislike Netanyahu, and who distrust Netanyahu, nevertheless vote for Netanyahu because he represents, and not because they're stupid. I am one of those people who think the voters aren't stupid, and pundits who think they're stupid are bad pundits. But because he represents and defends certain really subgroups of the Israeli society that otherwise feel marginalized and undefended. And political identity in Israel is very, very tribal because Israel is also very Middle Eastern. Israeli Jews, half of them really do come from the Arab world and think of themselves in that way. And it's one of our strengths, and it makes us a relatively happy society among developed societies. We have strong families and tribes. It's all, I want to say all of that just to be able to say Netanyahu enjoys a very strong tribal affinity among his voters. They're very resilient. They go with him when he makes terrible mistakes. On average, over the last 20 years, he's also delivered some very big successes and has been overall a very competent prime minister. Arguably, that's beginning to change. We're seeing this reform. We're seeing some other policy issues where he's not even committed. He's not even clinging to the policies he used to believe in. And so things are maybe changing. I think that if we held an election today, Netanyahu would lose maybe 5 seats. He might lose the election only because everything is very, 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 very close. But in terms of actual numbers of votes, I don't think he would lose a lot of points percentage-wise. So I think basically his voters are still with him. When they start to feel real pain, if this judicial overhaul really does pass as is, and that really does terribly harm the economy, you will begin to see real, real anger and real abandonment of Netanyahu and Likud. But that's not something we've seen yet.
Great. Thank you. Next question. My friend Nevit, who is out in the West Coast. Question about the structure of the Supreme Court itself. Can Supreme Court justices be removed, or are they replaced only when they die, retire, or resign?
And they have to retire at age 70.
At 70, okay. Okay. So no debate there.
Yeah, that's the law.
That's the law. And so as a follow-up to that, the one of the questions that came up before was a question about the press conference that Esther Chayut gave the other day, you know, the other day, you know, expressing her own political viewpoints. You know, what are your comments about that, you know, as far as Supreme Court judges, you know, expressing their opinions in such a way, you know, with all of this?
Yeah. You know, the right is very upset that she gave a speech against the reform. The Chief Justice of the Israeli Supreme Court is also a head of a branch of government. And so she, for example, has just literally personnel responsibility for all lower courts of the entire Israeli judiciary. And she sits on the committee that appoints all the judges. She has been the chair of a committee that appointed hundreds of judges. And so she is sees herself also as a defender, not of any particular policy, you know, not of any particular, I would say, way of understanding the role of the judiciary. The Knesset is the one that sets those constitutional boundaries, and that's something she has said many times. But the basic integrity of that system. And what she argued in that speech was, guys, you are no longer debating, you know, should the court have more checks or fewer checks, but we'll have checks with another maybe House of Parliament, or we'll have some other, a presidential, or you're not having that debate. What you're doing is simply removing the capacity of the judiciary to be a judiciary. You're pulling the rug out from the foundations of the system. And Yariv Levin was very hurt when she said that. And I have to tell you, I am someone who, just by personality, don't like panic. I don't like hysteria. I don't like people who have too strong emotions on politics, because politics is very professionalized and deeply, deeply manipulative today. And we live in a world that is essentially run by academic scientific manipulation methods that have developed over the last 40 years, of which social media algorithms are a small part that has us all worried, but that's a small part of it. And so I distrust strong emotions in politics. I have to tell you, I can't get out of Yariv Levine an answer as to why she's wrong. To me, it seems like the judges are being completely sidelined from any capacity. From they keep talking about America, but America has tremendous checks and balances next to the Supreme Court. In other words, it's a weaker court, but there's a president with a veto and two houses of Congress, and they in fact are elected by different cross-sectioning of the population and on different schedules. And those are all elements, as we learned from the Federalist Papers, of checks and balances. And we have none of it. We just have literally no other institution. And Yariv Levine simply won't tell us about that. Yariv Levine has refused for 3 months to interview in the press. The only interview he has given publicly is to a right-wing podcaster. And it's an interesting interview, but I don't think it counts. You're driving a deep and profound and maybe the most dramatic constitutional change in the country's history. Go in front of the frickin' cameras. Benjamin Netanyahu for 5 months has refused to interview to any media outlet that doesn't support him. I mean, avidly, passionately support him. I mean, Channel 14, which just is his in-house channel that deeply admires him. And the one interview he gave them was this fawning, admiring interview. He has gone on every podcast he could find in American Jewry. He went on the Tikva Foundation Fund podcast and on Barry Weiss's podcast. And with Ben Shapiro, he sat down to an interview. But he won't interview with us, and he won't interview with Channel 12, and he won't interview with all the big Israeli media outlets that are not in his pocket. And that is true for months. And so I think that the criticism of Esther Chayut is, I think it's reasonable that she came out with that speech. Well, even if you disagree with the speech, it's just we're at a point where we need to have a fundamental conversation about the judiciary and what is happening to it.
Great. Thank you.
And Netanyahu and the proponents of the reform are refusing to have that conversation, certainly in Hebrew.
Great. Thank you. So let me move on to our question by my friend and colleague Roger Gerber. Your point about the reasonable aspect. So, you know, Roger is pointing out that the Constitution and the statute does not actually use the word reasonable. And you know, the fact that Aaron Barak, you know, not to abolish the standing, but, you know, he basically said that any law or government action can be voided on the subjective grounds of reasonableness. And there is no such concept in the US system. So a case must be brought to the party of standing on the court and must deal with only the cases and the controversies. So maybe talk a little bit, you know, unpack a little
Sure. This is very comfortable for me because I have spent 10 years arguing that the Israeli Supreme Court is ridiculous and unconscionably powerful and not serious, and we need a much more serious constitutional process and other checks and balances. There is a cultural element to the powerful court that we have. Israel is a Jewish country. It also has, not coincidentally, the highest per capita number of lawyers in the world, and its judges all think that they're gods. And that is very, very profoundly rooted in Jewish culture. Now, that's maybe a cute way of saying, I think it's also true and serious and part of the reason it makes sense to Israelis to have such a powerful court, but our court is incredibly powerful and it's incredibly damaging. I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago in which I laid out the left-wing case against the court. The Israeli Supreme Court began this massive, massive uptick in its power, in the powers it has claimed for itself, against Rabin, against the Rabin government in the early 90s, and just literally decided that it gets to decide if Rabin's policy decisions are unreasonable. And in deciding that they're unreasonable, he actually weakened his government tremendously, forced Shas out of the coalition by demanding that he do something the law didn't demand that he do. And the court decision even said, the law doesn't require you to do this, but reasonableness requires you to do this. Which, by the way, was firing Arya Derry because he was going to be indicted for, you know, on corruption. So that, you know, deja vu. But that court at that time caused terrible damage to the Israeli left. And this is a court, the Israeli Supreme Court has ruled back in the 90s, in the Derry case, I believe in 1993, that the Israeli Supreme Court can only be the Israeli government can only be represented in court by the Attorney General. And the problem was that Rabin and his Attorney General disagreed on whether or not he should keep Derry in the cabinet. And the court literally ruled that Rabin doesn't get to represent himself. He can only be represented by an attorney that he doesn't get to decide who it is. He literally is not permitted to make his case to the court, the prime minister of the state of Israel. That standing of the making the attorney general the only, not giving Israeli governments, right, the expansion of standing, the expansion of justiciability. There's lawyers in the room, so you know, you'll know what that means better than I will. I basically understand what it means. But it's just astonishing and almost without limit and very, very problematic. The left agrees. In other words, President Isaac Herzog believes, former head of the Labour Party believes. I know many left-wingers who are very angry with these questions. I once interviewed Amnon Rubinstein, the author of The Basic Law, Human Dignity and Liberty, former Meretz education minister, very much an icon of the left, one of the great constitutional thinkers of the Israeli left. And in an interview to me, I think 13 years ago or so, he said that the Israeli Attorney General's office is too powerful. He cannot be both the legal advisor of the government and the chief prosecutor, because that means that when he sits down with the minister, he is both that minister's legal advisor and also the person who will investigate and prosecute that minister potentially. And that's simply a conflict of interest that the Israeli Attorney General wouldn't allow in any other part of government, but he allows for himself. And so I personally, sitting here, Chaviv, I'm obviously an objective journalist from Mars, but for the purpose of this conversation, I also personally support exactly the reform that they're advancing with the Attorney General's office, separating the Attorney General's role from the chief prosecutor's part of the Attorney General's role from the legal advisor of the government part of the Attorney General's role. A lot of this reform makes sense. Piecemeal, each piece is a worthwhile thing to consider. And the way they've pushed it forward and how it all clings together, they've destroyed the judiciary and leave us with no checks and balances of any kind. So absolutely, we need a reform, which is what makes it so tragic that we're stuck with this insane one, one that its own defenders can't defend and refuse to defend.
Great, thank you. Alex, I know you have a question. Why don't you take your question, given the fact that, you know, obviously there are no short answers here. So I want to be cognizant of Chaviv's time, and obviously there's a lot of questions coming and going. Again, I apologize, we're not going to get to everybody today, but we will do our best. And again, if we don't, please email us after the program. Go ahead, Alec.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks very much for a very comprehensive and very depressing presentation. And I have all sorts of questions. But I think I'll focus on one, and that's the question of Netanyahu, who is until now been famously sort of risk averse, famously able to reverse course, some would say to double cross, to backstab. What's his goal? Has he lost some kind of touch, which, you know, attributes some sort of magic to previous iterations of Netanyahu, but he's gotten himself into a situation of brinksmanship with the center left, and the center left in its previously weakened state is taking advantage for all that they're worth. But what's his strategic goal in all this? People would say early on in this process that he just wanted to get him pack a court to get himself off from corruption charges, but that's not how he thinks. He thinks in geostrategic terms, among other things. And the question of what he wants may have a clue to how he gets himself out of this and gets the society out of it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the $64,000 questions, right? His critics think that it's all about packing the court. In about probably 5-6 years, he will have exhausted all of his appeals and he'll be standing before a Supreme Court, which he can between now and then probably if he is reelected in 3 years, for another 3 years, let's say, he can, by the time he's standing before the court, have appointed with this reform six of its members, maybe even seven. And that's the goal, and there is no other goal, and he's just desperate to stay out of jail. I don't know that that's him. That's certainly not him 10 years ago. The man 10 years ago was a real serious and profound policy thinker. He didn't run campaigns in which he openly, you know, race-goaded Arabs, which he has done, and there's no way around it. I went into the Likud campaigns trying to find why this wasn't him, but it was in fact him. And he has, you know, his campaign manager, Ofer Golan, in an interview with us, said, first you win, then you do damage control. That is the way Likud works now. It's not Likud of 10 years ago. He has systematically taken over and gutted the party institutions. So there is no more Likud opposition to the party leader, which is a real change for the party. The party has always been loud and obnoxious and democratic, and there were primaries with screaming and people and camps and fighting, and that no longer exists. So maybe it is a different Netanyahu, and it really is just that. That I don't know how to prove it isn't. That's A. B, it is possible, you know, this is the only coalition. Again, I go back to a weakness. If Itamar Ben-Gvir, every single member of his coalition, every party in his coalition, he requires all of them, all together, all lined up, all sitting with him to survive. He doesn't actually, I mean, he won this enormous victory, but it's a victory in which he's dependent on even the most, you know, radical faction of the coalition. If Itamar Ben-Gvir steps out of his coalition, it falls. And so he is actually a leader who is deeply, deeply weak. Every single interview he's given, by the way, to every podcast in America, his one recurring theme is, I have both hands on the wheel. He literally used those words with Barry Weiss and with the Tikva podcast and with Ben Shapiro and with all these other groups. And CNN and, you know, ABC, he said, I have both hands on the wheel. And the reason he keeps telling people he has both hands on the wheel is that it's not at all clear that he has both hands on the wheel. And so Yariv Levine threatening to resign is something he has to really worry about. You know, Gaffney saying, I must have a 61 vote override no matter what, is a real problem for him. He doesn't have a way around that. He can't jettison them and bring in the center left, because no one on the center left trusts him anymore with how he treated, you know, Gantz and Lieberman and all the different lies that he, you literally can't sign a coalition agreement with him. There's a joke in the Knesset today, told by the Haredi allies of Netanyahu as much as by the left, that, you know, to do coalition negotiations, you need to work with credit. And with Netanyahu, you always take cash. You simply cannot rely on a promise. And so Netanyahu's negotiating room, his maneuvering room, is very, very narrow, both because of the electoral results, because of the actual numbers in his coalition, and because of his reputation. And that, I believe, is a big, I don't get into his, you know, his personal, what's in his soul. I don't know what's in his soul. He's a very profound and serious thinker. His soul is complicated. It's possible that three opposite things are all happening at once in his soul. But just if you look at the sheer politics of it, you can see the trap. He built that trap. And again, you shouldn't feel bad for him, but he is actually stuck in a political trap that's no clear way out of at this point.
Great, thank you. Alex, just because of time, I'm going to move on to one last question, because I know Habib is on a schedule.
Sure.
Just trying to consolidate a few comments that were raised for Habib, because I know we're not going to get to all of them. The comments, I guess, those of us living on this side of the Atlantic, you know, the question of you know, how everything has been viewed from here. There have been several individuals, people like Alan Dershowitz and Erwin Kotler and other jurists who've weighed in, and people are talking about that. You know, are these helpful, not helpful? The question of the, you know, the connection, you know, with this regard to the, you know, the fate or the nature of the current relationship between the American Jewish community and the state of Israel. Are those voices helpful, not helpful, counterproductive? You know, just, you know, your observation, given the fact that you've been covering this.
I don't think they move the needle at all. People who are opposed think that Alan Dershowitz's opposition is neat. It's not something that's being, you know, gone viral on Israeli Twitter or anything like that. And people who are for the reform think that Alan Dershowitz just doesn't understand, or, you know, sometimes he's very left-wing, sometimes he's very conservative. This is one of those times where he's on the other side. You know, it's just something that people aren't paying attention to. I'll tell you what they are paying very close attention to is the astounding economic and response, the real jitters of the high-tech industry that have translated into delays in investment and the fleeing of money out of the country. One of the problems with this reform, which we didn't touch on, and it's worth mentioning, at least in passing, is that here in a conversation like this between people like us, we can have a very considered and thoughtful, you know, principles and technicalities and which legislation and what does it mean and how it all stacks up. But in the sort of rough and tumble Knesset public debate, this reform has been depicted by its own people, by its own supporters, by Likud MKs, by Shas MKs, essentially as a war by half of Israel against the other half. You had people like Likud MK Dudi Amsalem. He got up in the Knesset, and at the Knesset podium, he said, all of the protesters, they're not worried. They're just rich and privileged and angry that they're not in charge anymore. I saw the glittering of all the Rolex watches in all of the protests. He screams that from the Knesset podium. Incidentally, Israelis had a lot of fun with that moment because he was wearing a $6,000 Cartier watch while he screamed about the protesters, you know, Rolexes. But that's been the argument. There's been a Shas member of Knesset who got up at a conference last week who said, you need to be scared, you left-wingers, because we're having more kids than you and we're taking over the country. Get used to it. That's how it's been. Now, if you're, I don't know how to put this politely, secular Israel is the productive Israel. Tel Aviv, the city of Tel Aviv, the income taxes coming out of the city of Tel Aviv fund the city of Jerusalem by about a billion shekels a year. There is the half of Israel that is not represented in this coalition. Again, not every individual. There's a lot of high-tech people who vote for Bibi. But the preponderance is not. The preponderance of high-tech is secular voting for Yesh Atid and for the left. And the preponderance of the people who produce the vast majority, the Israeli, right now, Israel is in this wonderfully prosperous place. Our GDP per capita is roughly New Zealand's. And it is New Zealand's, even though we have low participation in the workforce rates among Haredi men and Arab women. And so for these cultural choices, these traditional cultures that don't, that aren't economically very productive, even with them included in that, we are at an average of New Zealand's you know, GDP per capita. So we are a very wealthy country, but it's very lopsided. And the part that is out of power is the part that is productive and funding everybody else. And incidentally, is the part that's having fewer kids. That discourse is a thread running through everything being said here. It's in the Knesset every day. The protesters, when they scream, this is part of the anxiety and the fear and the anger and the frustration that they are talking about. And it's true on the other side. There's a feeling that we've been marginalized, and this elite, the elite is half the country, but nevertheless, they're this privileged elite. There's a lot of cultural anger. And that cultural anger, I think, has driven a lot of also the anxiety and the panic and the hysteria. There's more happening here than a judicial debate. One of the tragedies of this reform, A, is how the politics are forcing a bad version of the reform to pass, a version Netanyahu even claims he doesn't want, but also that the events
as there seems to be a problem on Khabib's end. I'm not sure what happened. Let me see if we can get him back as we lost him here. Alex, you're still there?
I am.
Okay. Again, I was saying that we lost Khabib here. Could be technical issues on the Israeli side, and we apologize for that. Let's try to. Unfortunately, our time is indeed already. We're close to an end, so I'm going to. We're going to wrap up this afternoon. I thank everybody for joining us this afternoon. I know there's a lot to talk about, and obviously, this is a topic that is close to many of us, and we will continue this debate and conversation going forward. I'll thank Khabib in advance here, even though he's not with us right now, for joining us this afternoon. And we hope that he'll be able to join us at a later time and discuss any ongoing later developments as always. Khabib, are you back? Khabib? Are you back? Khabib? Can you hear us, Khabib? We can't hear you. Let's see. Khabib is back. 1 second, but we still can't hear him. Let's see if he's able to get his audio. Khabib, are you back?
Hi, I'm back. I apologize. I think one of my kids pulled a cable back there.
I was thanking you. I didn't know if it was something we said that you had to leave us, but let me. I know you have to. So why I'll let you wrap up because I know you're also on a time schedule.
What I was finishing up saying was just that this is a fight over the judiciary, over our constitutional order. It is a fight that, so much of what many of the people in this government want is just supported by most of the public. We know it when we ask the question carefully and with nuance. Most of the public does want a lot of what this government wants, but it's advanced as a kind of culture war and with profound just anger and a refusal to have a serious public debate in Hebrew. You have been able in English to hear our prime minister and more on this question than Israelis have been able to in Hebrew. And that's a hard, simple fact, and it's a very sad one. And it plays into all of these questions of, which part of Israel is funding which other parts, and can Haredi society as it expands as a percentage of the population be sustainable? All of those anxieties and all of those questions about the Israeli future all play into this anxiety. And so we're in a really powerful and important, turning point in our or crossroads in defining our future. One sentence to end it. Israel has a habit of having terrible, terrible crises that force it to become much, much better and come out of those crises vastly stronger. The 73 war showed us the hollowing of, our arrogance and our intelligence and our military, and we created a whole new intelligence apparatus in world that just has saved the country time and again since. In the 1980s, people here will remember we had runaway inflation, something like 8 years of triple-digit inflation, right? Joe Biden just spent half of last year less popular than Donald Trump because of 9% inflation. Well, imagine 200%, and imagine 200% year on year for 8 years. Israel in the 80s went through this incredibly profound fiscal crisis, and today is one of the most fiscally responsible countries in the world. I believe our deficit last year was zero, and that's not because we're fantastic stewards of our economy, but because we're post-traumatic stewards of our economy. We have this habit of having to collapse before we build ourselves bigger. We're in one of those moments, and it's being handled incredibly poorly by Netanyahu, by the government, by Yariv Levine and Simcha Rotman. They're not giving us answers. They're pushing a reform that, if it passes as is, shouldn't pass, and even they won't defend it in any detail, in any serious way, in the news or on television. But there is, in this moment, a better reform that leaves us stronger. That is something that President Herzog, a left winger, politically in the past, has said, and I think is very, very true. And we still have to find a political path to that. That's Netanyahu's responsibility. You know, when you're in power, you're responsible. The fact that the left made mistakes in the past isn't relevant to what the person in power now has to do and the responsibility they have for the country. So there is reason for optimism. Israel isn't collapsing. It's not dead in the water. It's not dying. But people have to, you know, we have to have a political leadership, a leadership that understands this moment and understands its responsibility. And then maybe we can get to that very good place out of this very bad one.
Great. Khabib, again, thank you for everything. Thank you for unpacking all of this. There's obviously a lot to talk about. Hopefully you could come back, you know, and talk about more issues as they develop. And I want to thank again everybody for joining us this afternoon or this morning, depending on what coast you're on. And please be on the lookout for future webinars. Alex, as always, I thank you for joining us as well. And we will talk soon. So everybody have a good day. And a good evening to you, Khabib.